Thank you. You're so kind.
Yay. I wasn't sure I was going to get a chance to talk today. I want to thank all the people for, this has been fun. I've enjoyed all the people I've met. I fell in love with Joanne, and she told me I was too tall for her, you know. I did not look forward to coming up here, and I'll tell you why. The last couple of weeks, my daughter, who 7 years ago had a tumor removed from her brain, she's been through this COVID thing for like 2 years, and you know, totally isolating, being really very good, reprimanding me for all the gross, how badly I kind of treated it, she got a lot of crap from her soon-to-be mother-in-law for not letting her mother-in-law see her son. And so she finally gave in April on Easter Sunday. And she sat down next to her soon-to-be father-in-law, who had talked with his sister the night before, had met with her. She had just gotten off a boat, and she had a little cough, he's coughing and he's not okay. And my daughter calls me from Easter brunch and she goes, "I don't want to go back out to the table. He's got COVID." And I was like, "Oh, honey, these are your in-laws." You're supposed to be, understanding. She goes, "You don't understand, Dad. He is coughing everywhere." But the problem with her is that she has a very compromised immune system. So it scares her, and that, sure enough, Tuesday morning, she went into an adrenal shutdown, and she had to go into ICU, and it was like, it's tough, and she was really angry, which is why I'm so glad I have this program, because I gave her all my four-step knowledge, about finding fault, and perhaps they're spiritually sick, and she said, "Dad, they're just stupid," And I was like, "And there's that, darling. And they're just old hippies from Napa Valley, and they just don't get it, da 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 da." So I had to listen to that for 45 minutes, but it showed me she was feeling okay, And God love her. I mean, she had to take a math test while on a respirator. Where do you get kids like that? It's like, good Lord. She got a 99, by the way, which is pretty amazing, because she is really sick. I'm not trying to make light of it. It's very serious, but it's been serious for 7 years. We've been in and out of, a lot of ICUs for the last 7 years, and it's been a tough deal. And she is, I don't know where she got that kind of stamina, she's a delight, and it's just Monday, she wanted to be released, she felt like everything was going okay, and they found something else wrong. So it's just a lot of just disappointment and trying to deal with that, and work, because every morning I go into work and the Russians are going to do this, and the government's going to do that, and financial markets are going crazy, and my clients are like, "Why are you so calm?" And I'm like, "Well, there's not a lot I can do about it today, And so I saw this thing just for today, and I thought, "Well, that pretty much sums up my life right now, my talk will be dominated by rabbit holes and bunny trails. Just so you know, I'm giving you warning. I get on subjects, but then I get a better idea, My boss asks me all the time, he goes, "Why do you put all that stuff on spreadsheets?" And I just kind of look at him and I go, "Well, it helps me to think." And that's not the truth. That's a bold-faced lie. What it does is it helps me to remember, okay, that's the math. What's going on up here is just not always rational. You know, I have this very quick brain, you know, that's got a lot of biases in it. And it has to be kind of defanged a lot, you know, and so my rational brain comes back. So that's why I put it all on spreadsheets so that I could see it, you know. And so I don't make any decisions like, oh, let's get rid of that, you know, without any justification. But see, I've already gone off on a bunny trail. You know? Anyways, so my girlfriend comes back from Chicago. I'm so excited. We're going to go do her birthday, her late birthday celebration at Disneyland. I pick her up from her house, and we drive down to Starbucks and get some coffee. And we come out of Starbucks, and up the hill, it's all kind of looks like it's on fire, you know? And we're like, huh, maybe we should go look at that, you know? And we drive up the hill, past her house, and over the crest, and there are just nothing but cars. And they're all standing, looking down the canyon. And so we go and stand and look down the canyon. There's a brush fire running up the canyon. The wind's blowing really hard, and it's moving really fast. And when it hit this house on the promenade, we decided maybe it was time to go and start packing, you know? And it just really engulfed everything in a heartbeat, you know? And I was still thinking we were going to get to Disneyland, which will show you kind of how rational I am. And she was thinking that we weren't going to get to Disneyland. And she goes, why don't you go check it out again? Because you're of no use to me right now. I can't tell what's valuable in her house and what's not. It's like a lot of paintings, a lot of stuff. I'm just not sure. And so I go up the street. It's about 700 yards away. And it's just a thick cloud of smoke. And I can see the fire through the smoke. And I was like, eh, that looks bad. You know, and so I came running back, and we evacuated and got her stuff out. I had to pull her out of the garage, so she was putting the dog carrier in the car, too. I was like, we can replace the dog carrier, you know. So anyways, that was all Thursday was cleaning up, and then Friday I was trying to get ready to come up here, and I thought, I don't really want to go up there, you know. But it was like, got everything cleaned up and every, you know, and I just feel happy to be here, you know. I feel like this is a gift, you know, and every time I have a chance to give this gift, you know, I do it. I don't ask why, I don't think about it, I just go. I just say yes. Because Christmas night, 1975, actually Christmas morning, of 1975 is one that I remember every minute of that day. I had been sober for 8 days, again, on my own. I'd been doing this on and off for about 6 months. And I had 8 days this time, you know. And my girlfriend asked me to go to Mass, midnight Mass. And I thought, all right, you know, we'll do that. And we went to Mass, and we came home, and we were literally roasting chestnuts on the open fire. And they opened a bottle of wine, or a champagne, and she handed me a glass, and I drank it. I didn't give it, I mean, there was, now, I'd been in juvenile hall just recently. I had totaled my car and three others. I had, let's just say I'd been in a lot of trouble for a few months. You know, I'd been on a streak of bad luck, you know. And so it was like, when I left her house that night, I kept saying to myself, Tim, there's something wrong with you. And I hated myself because I couldn't quit. I couldn't just stop. I couldn't just put it away. I couldn't explain why I drank. I wasn't in a bad mood. I was happy. My girlfriend was talking to me. Those were two things that went hand in hand. You know, I was rather undependable, and she was a very conservative girl, and she was probably getting close to having enough of me. And, so the deal is I was up all night. And being up all night, my dad came in that morning to tell me to get up and celebrate Christmas with the family. So I have five brothers and a sister, I told him, F you, and he told me, you're not welcome in this house, and he tried to grab me by the shirt, and I tried to get by him, and it's a narrow doorway, and he's not big, but he's got a bad attitude, he grabbed me and punched me, and it wasn't really a fight, it was him beating up on me. I'm an abused child, I pushed past him, and I went out, and I drove around, and I was miserable. I couldn't figure out what I was going to do next. I couldn't figure out. I knew I wasn't welcome at home. I couldn't go anywhere. All the friends that I had were, why do you drink so much, and what the hell's wrong with you, and blah, 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 blah. And so I went surfing. And when I got out of the water and I came back to the house, my dad kind of reinforcing the idea that I needed to move out, I went over to my girlfriend's house, and she was having a party with her friends, and my old girlfriend was there, and this other girl wanted a date, and, they were all talking to this one guy, and I kept turning the music up louder and louder and louder. And my girlfriend goes, "What the F is wrong with you?" So then I was able to tell her and explain to her deep in my soul what I thought was wrong with me. And she just goes, "Get out of here," I got up to the curb, and I was just sitting there, and I swear to God, the only thought that I had in my head is I should go to that AA thing, Because I'd been to an AA meetings. I had been in Alateen for because there were some cute girls in Alateen, So I knew where a meeting was, and I walked in there, and the woman was standing on a podium like this, and she had on a black cocktail dress and white pearls and little reading glasses, and I thought, God, my life is so over. this does not look good, The guy I sat next to, I tried to light a cigarette too, and I started slobbering all over it. It went out. I couldn't keep it lit. Then I put my hands under my butt, just because they were shaking, And he goes to me, leans over, and he goes, "You look like a dog on a freeway," I was like, "Thank you," And all of a sudden, from across the room, I see my Al-Anon, or not my Al-Anon, the AA guy that went to the Alateen meeting, he was a sponsor there, right? And he'd been watching me kind of do all this goofy stuff. And his eyes got really bright. Now, okay, I'm not dumb, but I wasn't. Eyes weren't brightening up around me lately, and unless I had drugs, my nickname was Felix the Cat, because Felix had a bag of tricks, and I always seemed to have something. And I was also the night manager at Sand Dune Liquor, so I always had alcohol and drugs, that was part of who I was. And Greg, God love him, he is a smallish guy, kind of mousy with kind of Danny Partridge-like hair. And he sat me in his little Datsun 1600, and he said I didn't have to drink anymore if I didn't want to. And I'll tell you what, for the first time in forever, I told him how badly I hurt inside. Because I'm, as you can tell, I'm a smartass. And I will keep you at a distance. Just because of my size alone, I kept a lot of people from, you know, getting close to me. You know, I didn't like being touched. I didn't like people pushing me around. I was a fighter. You know, I loved to brawl. Five brothers, man, you had to fight your way out of the bathroom and into the kitchen. I mean, it was a little bit nuts, you know. And my mom let it go because she couldn't control my oldest brother. And, you know, so there was a lot going on there. But anyways, different story, you know. Let that go. But it was the kind of thing that I just, I told him for the first time how badly I hurt inside, you know, and how screwed up my life was, and, you know, how I didn't know what to do any longer. I'd run out of options. And if I actually had known how many options I still had, you know, I was 17 years old, you know, physically, I probably would have recovered from all that. Mentally, maybe, you know. But it all seemed to be perfect at that point in time. You know, and that's why I'm always grateful. I heard a lot of things, you know, from people tonight or today and yesterday. You know, it was just the hand of AA reached out and pulled me in. All those old men, you know, that were... The only thing you could hear sometimes sitting next to them is their arteries hardening, you know, and they were so nice to me, though, you know, they were so patient, you know, and I had a ton of fun, you know. I come from a family of, we're Irish Catholic, God, no kidding, you know, and my parents were both born in the U.S., but all of my grandparents were from Ireland. Well, technically, my grandfather is from Glasgow, Scotland, and it's the worst kind of human being in the world. I mean, they're very dark people. You really have to get to know him. You know, he was a peach. And but it was just that kind of, you know, old world type of thing. Now, just so you know and understand from the rest of my story, my dad's idea for me was I'm the fourth child, and I was going to be the priest. I tried to dissuade him of that very often, and he never gave up courage. He said every time I fell down, he goes, Tim, that really, God's probably just trying to tell you, you know, that you're meant to be a priest. And I was like, no, God ain't telling me that much. He ain't talking to me. And he don't really like me, Dad. I don't know if you picked up on that. But he didn't really care a lot for me, you know. And it was just, but we had that kind of background. We grew up in New Jersey for the most part, a little bit of New York, you know. And we came out to California, and that was just wonderful. I've heard these people talk all the time about, you know, this point where you're different from others. And it was very clear with a New Jersey accent, you are technically different from others. I mean, kids in my class would, you know, we're in the San Fernando Valley, and they're going, say that again, you know. I go to the shore, you know, you're going to the beach, you know. It's like conversations like that all the time. It's not coffee, it's coffee, you know. It's like whatever, you know. And it was weird. I mean, it was weird being me. And you know, so that's why when I'm in AA 46 years, I technically, there's so much I should have learned by now, you know. I mean, really, to be practical, I write it down now. I keep it a list in my phone. Because it's like I'm thinking this stuff should be familiar to me. You know, I've heard it enough times. I've been to enough meetings, you know. But that's why it's like a kaleidoscope in my mind. You know, you look in the kaleidoscope and it just change it a little bit and everything changes. You know, and that's what my experience in AA is. I'm not a God person. You know, I'm not going to tell you I went out and talked to the big dude and he like opened the waters for me. You know, it wasn't ever like that. You know, I'm a searcher. You know, and I that's the thing I love the most about this program, because I found out Bill Wilson was a searcher too. One time he asked, Chuck Chamberlain used to be not a friend of mine, but I talk with him, you know, and he used to tell me that Bill Wilson used to make him, he would interrogate him, because Chuck was kind of, he was spiritual, you know, and Bill couldn't figure out if he was kind of lying to him or not. I was like, what do you mean lying? And he goes, well, he's kind of saying, you know, that some of this is just, you know, made up in my own mind, you know. So I was like, I like that. I like the idea. There's another rabbit hole, but I'm just going to run it by you and I'm going to get back on track. But it's like there's a book written recently about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I love this. Just for today, I want to tell you that that first edition, that that truly is a miracle. There's a lot of, miracle is a very overused word, you know. But that's a miracle. Because if you found out that Bill was the only one that wrote that, you know, Hank Parker was a psychiatrist, basically wanted a psychiatric approach to AA. In the meantime, they're not getting hardly anybody sober. And Dr. Bob is getting 50, 60 guys. He's getting them all sober, you know, back in Akron. He's sending them through the thing, and they're getting into the Akron program. And that first 100 looked more like about 97. You know, and all the ones that were kind of in the program, those were Bill's. And all the guys that were solid members, those were Dr. Bob's, you know. And if you doubt me, it's like you just got to look at the correspondence and the letters between Dr. Bob and Bill and the questions. So that's when I started to get really interested in that story. Because ultimately, it's like the steps were formulated from him stealing ideas from everywhere. Everywhere you've ever seen. Like the second step of the program, came to believe, is from a talk by, I'm going to get it, but he was a psychiatrist at the time, William James, at Harvard. And he gave a talk called Willing to Believe. And if you want to get the book, I would go get it. Because it talks about empirical evidence and why alcoholism was not considered by the medical community as an illness, and because they didn't have enough data. They didn't have anything that would support something that was so contrary to what they believed, you know. And faith, you know, was all that we really had to go on, is that these 100 guys and all this, you know, that had occurred, that this social movement, you know, was on faith. It was faith-based. It had no medical history in order to be established from it. So it's like, then you start to realize Bill's stealing that, he's stealing, you know, taking a little here, taking a little there, and all of a sudden he comes up with this 12 steps, you know? And you're like looking at that, and that's the miracle part. You know, it still takes my breath away. You know, when you realize I played basketball all over the world, and the countries that I went into and the programs, identical. You know, you sit in a German meeting in AA, and my German sucks, but Alkoholiker und Trinken, you know, I mean, it's like you can hear it. It almost sounds like English because you've heard it a million times already. You know, it was so amazing. You know, Ireland, where I got, you know, I'm still going down that road. I'm going to come back. But I went to a conference in Ireland, and these people sat with me, and I was probably 4 years sober at the time. And they were like, you know Chuck C? You know, I sat on his porch once. And I was like, good for you, you know, like, wow, that's a real, that's bleak. And I couldn't believe the meetings were very dour. They were like, they were not really excited about this. And I was scared because I was going to be there for a month. You know, I had been teaching in Queen's College in Belfast, which is a very exciting place in the 80s. I'll tell you, there was a lot of bombs going off and crazy making, you know. And I went to this meeting and I was thinking, oh, I'm in so much trouble, you know. But when I came out, they said, let's go get some coffee. And I swear to God, these guys talked about it. We laughed and talked until like 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, and we talked about sobriety. We talked about all the things that, you know, we've come to appreciate and how lucky we are, you know. So that's this thing that I got just from saying that I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, and my life had become unmanageable. That was that first step that I had towards doing it, because this is what kind of drunk I am. Well, okay, I got out of the Catholic Church because their God really did not appeal to me, and he didn't look like he liked me, so it was a mutually agreed upon. And I'm an ex-altar boy, because apparently you're not supposed to steal wine out of the sacristy. You're supposed to give it to the people, you know. And me and a couple other friends, we got the wine, and we used to go into the park and go get drunk. And Father Diamond caught us, and I was no longer an altar boy. And I was a Boy Scout for a bit, except I was going towards my life badge, and apparently alcohol consumption and drugs were not a merit badge for some, you know. And we were going on hikes, and I was dropping acid, and things were a little fuzzy, you know, like, it's not for any other reason than it's kind of like driving with the one eye. If I had known that at 14, if I could just close one eye, that I'd eliminate that problem, it would have been good, you know, because then I could have just stayed right on that trail, you know. But evidently my scoutmaster really didn't appreciate, you know, what I was, the kind of things that I was doing. So I was very quickly, and this is before I'm 14. So my parents, after my sixth arrest, sent me to a court-appointed psychiatrist. And just to let you know, my winning streak continued with him. He got up from his desk one day and went out to do something. I reached into his wallet and stole $20. And I was sitting, because we played Sorry Charlie every Thursday for months and months and months. And I never said anything to him, and he never asked me to say anything, you know, never asked me any questions. And so I just thought it'd be kind of fun. You know, I was bored, and he didn't appreciate that. He told my parents that I was a sociopath and that they should expect me to die by my own hand, be incarcerated, or institutionalized. That's what they told my parents when I was 14. So it's amazing how close that is to what AA told me, you know. There was like this real tight correlation there, you know. And but that was like, and it got worse from there. It didn't really get better, you know. It was like there was a lot of drinking and a lot of, you know, running away from home. My parents hunting me down, you know, because I was having way too much fun, and they didn't appreciate that. And, you know, I kind of did better, and I got myself in shape in my junior year, and I got a couple offers in basketball. And, you know, I have the notoriety of being the only guy in my CIF to ever knock down Bill Lambiers, and I know some of you probably don't know him, but he's like 6'11", and he played on the Detroit Pistons. He was a bad boy, you know, and I knocked him flat and stood over him. And, you know, so I had a kind of an anger issue, and My senior year, we had a new coach. He didn't think I was as funny as I thought I was, and he didn't appreciate that I didn't follow what he thought. I didn't think he was very smart. I thought he was something out of the 50s. I thought he was a Bob Cousy, two-handed jump shot kind of guy, you know, and he didn't like that. And so I didn't play in my senior year, and my whole senior year just got flushed. And, you know, and then I told you a little bit about what happened. It's just a few car crashes. One time I came out of the parking lot, hit a bumper, and looked around very carefully to see if anybody had seen me, and then proceeded to let the clutch back out and hit it again, you know. So that's what kind of driver I am. I'm a perfect date. I took the cutest cheerleader to a party, and we drove into the party, and there was a keg, and there was our friends. And she went over to where our friends were standing, and I went over to where the keg was, and she tugged on my arm at like 10 o'clock and said, "It's time to go," you know? And this was a date, technically. And I looked at her, and I was like, oh, and I got in the car, and I blacked out, you know? And I remember driving down the freeway when I came back out of that blackout, and I was like freaked. I just freaked. I was like, and she goes, "Are you okay?" And I wasn't going to tell her. I just kind of came to, you know? I didn't think that was a real conversation starter, you know? And I just wanted to get her home and get her out of the car. That's what I wanted to do, you know? And it was funny because about 5 years later, she's a flight attendant, and I see her in Denver, and I apologize to her for putting her life in danger. And told her I was very sorry for that, you know, and she goes, "Oh my God, I just thought you didn't like me." And I was like, all right, you know. But it was, that's what kind of drinker I am. If I start, there's not enough booze, you know. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. And everybody would tell me, my brother especially, because he's only a year younger than me, he would say, "God, why do you have to drink so much?" You know, and I'd just be like, "I don't know, why are you such a jackass?" You know, and it just, I lost, my world shrunk. Every time I screwed up again, it got smaller and smaller and smaller until I told you that night, sitting out on that curb, that I didn't have one person that I knew that I could go to. You know, right that at that minute, because my world had gotten so small and people had gotten very intolerant, you know, of me. So it's like I got into AA, and then, like I said, these guys pulled me in, you know, and a lot of great things happened. I went to meetings, I went to so many meetings in my first 30 days that my parents took me out to brunch, and a champagne brunch, and told me I was taking myself too seriously. And I asked my dad, because I thought they were trying to kill me, I said, "You know, Dad, when I was in San Diego Juvenile Hall, possession of dangerous narcotics, distribution of dangerous narcotics, you said over the phone, 'Let him rot.'" I think those were your exact words, you know. And he goes, "Yeah, but," and I said, "Yeah, so just trust me on this, Dad. I'm going to be okay, you know, I'm going to be okay. These people care about me. They understand me." And I went and made a big deal out of being an alcoholic, you know, and I have a problem with alcohol. I have an allergy to alcohol, and I have an obsession. My sponsor used to tell me I only had two problems with alcohol: drinking and not drinking, you know, because if I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about it. I'm calculating. I'm wondering what I need to do, where I need to go, who I need to talk to. You know, I'm obsessed with alcohol. And that's why it still amazes me to this day. You know, it's like, how did that just go away? I can't do that with peanut M&Ms. You know, I can't do it with chocolate cookies. You know, I can't do it with other stuff, you know, other food items, but I can with alcohol. You know, I because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get that, I can do that, you know. When I was a few months sober, I decided to go back to school. And I was at West LA Junior College, and I was playing against these guys. They seemed okay, you know, and, you know, I just was minding my own business, and this guy's standing there on the wall, and he's watching me. And I'm just like, you know, when you're me, you're thinking you did something wrong, you know. It's like, he comes up to me and he goes, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Well, I'm just playing basketball, you know. I'm not doing anything, sir." You know, it's like that whole, I went to school this morning. I mean, I felt like I was talking to a police officer. And he asked me why I didn't come out for the team. And I told him, I just vomited out why he didn't need me on his team. I was like, I am worthless. Just so you know, my entire self-worth is formed by people that are angry at me. You know, so it's like, I'm not like thinking any positive thoughts here, you know, and I just vomited out all that stuff. And he said, "You know what?" He goes, "Everybody deserves a second chance." And that was the weirdest thing. I really believed it. I don't know why. I can't tell you why. You know, I just know that him and I, till the day he died, he was like the father that I always wanted, you know. And he pulled me out. I have a really bad temper, you know, or had a really short fuse. Most of my teammates called me an assassin, a junkyard dog, you know, a jackass, you know. I got in a lot of fights with my own teammates, with the other team, you know. The only two times I ever really got in the paper were kind of funny, but the Denver paper said, "The aggressive style of the junior college players, you know, game really lent a lot to the win," you know. But what he meant was, it pissed me, my coach thought it pissed me off that I couldn't score, because I'd been drinking all during high school. I wasn't playing, you know. But it pissed me off so much that I hated when the other guy on the other team scored. So my coach would just sick me on him, you know. And I would do everything I can to get in his head, you know. And the other time was in Finland, you know, when they made a rather derogatory remark about Americans in general and me specifically, you know, because I beat up on their little star player, like the little princess got his feelings hurt, you know. I was like, you know, I played in South Central, and if you had feelings at all, they weren't very helpful to you, you know. And so, I mean, I would do anything for this guy. You know, I had straight A's. I had 7 A's and 1 B in my first semester, and I thought they had given me the wrong report card. I was sure that, like, no way. You know, because they told me in my senior year that I should be, like, some kind of construction worker or a bricklayer. That's what they, you know, something simple, you know, that you could do in high repetitions, you know, and without thinking. So it just, I mean, this is the kind of thing I got in here with, you know. So I came to believe that there was a power greater than myself, because you guys showed me that it was so. I didn't want to believe in God. I didn't care for the Catholic God. I didn't care at all for people that talked incessantly about God intervening in their life. You know, to me, that was like, that did not happen. No matter how many times I'd asked him for help, I never saw that, you know. But I was told I didn't have to, you know, I was just told to believe in a power greater than myself, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this entity, you know. It's kind of like theory, you know. It's you have faith that all these people in all these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous are not lying to you. You know, that if you put the plug in the jug and you stop drinking, that you have a chance to live a life, you know, and I did. You know, I lived an amazing life. You know, I graduated from the University of Denver, you know, and I got to play for a guy. It was a real treat, you know, and I had a ton of fun. Like I said, I played basketball all over the world. You know, I had a ton of fun doing that. You know, I came back to Earth with the normal people and got a job. And it was very hard on me because little people like to feel like they have something going for them, you know, to something to be proud of, you know. And it was like you're talking with them, and I'm used to like other discussions. And, you know, it's just funny. I had to learn how to, hold my temper down. All of a sudden, people took it very wrongly if they saw me, my temper flare up, you know. And I finally had to start thinking about these steps, so I got a different sponsor. And I gotta tell you, the first time he saw my fourth step, he said to me, "Tim, you're not a victim," because I told him my victim tale, you know. And he said, "I want you to go back and do this a different way. I want you to go back and I want you to separate out people that were perhaps spiritually sick from the behavior that you exhibited, so that you can get closer to the truth of what you're doing." You know, and I went to church, first of all, and then I got in the pew and I said my Hail Marys. And it was, you know, I really wanted to get this. You know, it wasn't like a kind of half-hearted, I really wanted to move past this, you know, and start getting this calm and joy that these people talked about in the meetings. And so I went through that exercise, and he said, "You know, I you still don't get it." And I got so pissed, I came over the table, and he picked up a baseball bat. And I was like, okay, maybe I shouldn't, like, maybe it's time for me to go, you know. And that's how I finally found a sponsor, and I remember sitting Sean Allen, and I remember sitting in his kitchen one Saturday morning, and I read him my inventory. And I told him about how sick I felt inside, and why I did this and why I did that, and how fearful I was, you know. And we did it right out of the book. And at the very end, I fully expected him to go, "Thank you, you're not worth saving." I really did. I thought I had told him everything. I laid it all out there. What a jerk I was, how I abused everyone that bothered to be helpful to me, you know. And what he did was, and I get chills today about it, and I know that must sound stupid, but he got up from the table and he put his arms around me. And I don't let people do that, you know. I do it a lot more. My kids think it's funny to grab me and hold me. I think it's dangerous, you know, but I'm getting a lot better at it, you know. And he said, "I love you, and I want you to know something. You're worth loving. There's a side of you in there that's generous. There's a side of you in there that loves people." And he goes, "I would really like you to be able to feel that today. I know you probably don't. I know you're probably scared that this, like everything else, is not going to work." You know, and we went and we did the rest, with time alone, the rest of the steps. And, you know, when we started to make the amends, and, you know, when you're 17 years old, it's like, you know, I got to replace the packet of Razzles that I stole, you know, or most of it was to my parents. You know, a lot of it was to my school, the administration at my school, You know, a lot of, one of it was to the police sergeant in the Pacific Division that was 5'8", and I told him that he barely made the height code for, and he made sure that every cop in the Pacific Division would stop me whenever they saw me. You know, so I was that kind of smart ass, you know, and so I just did that side of it. I mended the fences that I could, and I'm so glad I did, because later in life, in the rest of my sobriety, I've needed that tool chest. You know, I've gotten myself in trouble, that bad things have happened, you know, and I needed a way to get out of it. And those, the program gave me those tools. You know, it stopped being theory and it became very practical. You know, my experience is just, has been wonderful. You know, I've been in H&I for most of my sobriety, you know, because it was like the one place where I could go with all the other gladiators, you know, and I remember Chino YTA and sitting in that room, and I felt more comfortable in that room than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because it just, I knew what they were capable. I knew what they were thinking about. I knew what they were going to do, how they were going to react. And like, I didn't have a clue as to how you people were going to react or why you would even like me or what was valuable about me. I had no self-worth. I told you, my entire self-worth was formed by people that were angry with me, you know. So it was like I began to learn how to give, you know, and I did a lot of panels and a lot of work. I went out, I was like a circuit speaker for a little bit, and I got to fly all around the country, and I got to hear my charming little story, and, you know, it was like I was in a meeting one time with a guy, oh God, I hate this, doctor or something, down in Orange County. God, I don't remember his name, I'm sorry. But he was famous. He'd written a story, it was in the big book, you know, Dr. Paul. And I gave my 15-minute talk, and afterwards they were supposed to ask questions, you know. And he pulled me by the sleeve and sat me down. He goes, I'm gonna take this over for you, you know. And I was like, I turned to him, I said, you know, I didn't ask to come down here, you know. So he and I never really talked again, surprise. But it was like, he was the only one that I could ever remember that, you know, I had guys that would say stupid stuff to me, like, you know, Serenity Sam used to have a meeting Wednesday nights, and Serenity Sam, if you don't have never heard that name, he was like, there was this side of AA where they did everything right and stayed sober, and there was this side of AA, Sam's side of AA, where it was all, it was a everybody for themselves, you know. Like, Sam was beautiful. You know, and I'm sitting in the kitchen one time, and I'm scrubbing the coffee, because that's when we had coffee cups and ashtrays, and I'm cleaning them away, and this guy with his little white shoes and insurance man boots and a belt, and telling me, you know, I drank more than you, I spilled more on my tie than you drank, you know. And Sam came in, and he used to call me Flash, because he said I was momentarily brilliant. He put his arm around me. He goes, you just tell this old shit that you weren't too young to die, you know? And I was like, that was the first time in my life in AA I felt like this guy's got my back, you know? I went into a meeting one time, a little Alateen meeting, and I'm going in the door. It was a dance, and I had the speaker, this guy grabbed me by the shirt of my, by my shirt. And he pulled me out. He goes, come here, you little wolf. And he took me over to the AA meeting, and he sat me down. You know, he went up to the podium and talked about the instincts of salmon and something else. And then Chuck came back down and sat with me and talked with me. Chuck Chamberlain he was like an athlete kind of guy, you know. And he talked to me, and I was like, who is this guy, you know. But he had that kind of thing where it was like he just asked me questions. And you know, I had such a wonderful time. Norm Alpe, Eddie Cochran, you know, it was just like Eddie Regan. These guys just pulled me in, held on to me, and told me that I didn't have to drink again if I didn't want to, you know? And so it's like, that's all I'm here to tell you, you know, is that you can have a life here. And it's been up and down, I gotta tell you. My girl meets boy on, or boy meets girl on AA campus really hasn't panned out for me yet, you know? My first wife died of alcohol and alcohol poisoning. You know, she decided to go back to drinking and I divorced her. You know, and I had a baby girl there who is just, she's the one with the COVID and she's just a beaut. You know, she's smart, 2 degrees. You know, I don't know where she came from, frankly, you know, but she's, I love her and she loves me and she depends on me to be me. You know, and I married another woman. I thought I had struck the mother lode, you know. I thought she was really smart. She loves sports. You gotta love a woman that loves sports, you know, because I do a lot of sporting, sports ball, my daughter calls it. And, you know, but she had a mental illness, you know, and, she had manic depressive bipolar, and it came about when our second child was born, and she never recovered from that. She never, the medication, it was a lot of years, a decade, of a wasted decade, you know, and but I have 2 kids with her that are both delightful. I have a 6'8" son who embarrasses me in athletics on a daily basis or every time she gets. You know, luckily I'm getting older, so I won't subject myself to the humiliation of being beat by him. But, and I have a baby girl that she just had a baby, Kimberly, you know, so I'm a grandfather. And I just think that is just freaking awesome, you know, because it's like I could have so much fun to her and then I just get to go, here, honey, you know. But I'm good with diapers, I'm dependable. You know, I'm good with all the spilling of all the stuff and I'm good with all that, but I just don't wanna lose any more sleep than I'm already bad enough as that. But I have that kind of story. You know, it's not anything spectacular. I've been employed in the same industry for 36 years. You know, I've raised these 3 kids virtually. My oldest daughter I've raised pretty much by myself, you know, and the other 2 kids, because of their mother's illness, the same story, you know. I coached high school basketball with my friend for 16 years. You know, I sponsor a ton of guys. I'm involved in H&I, you know, and I just, none of that might mean anything to you, but what means something is God has found a use for me. You know, he's made me a useful human being. I've got a lot of guys I sponsor and we do the drill, you know, and then they get sponsees, you know, and some guy walked up to me, I was speaking somewhere and he goes, I'm your great, great, great sponsee or whatever. And I was like, well, good for you. You know, like, I'm not a heart warmer, but what I am is I'm very grateful that God gave me an opportunity to prove that I was worth saving. Because that's the one thing I didn't believe, that I would that anything would become of me. I was arrogant, I'm angry, I was frightened. I didn't have any redeeming qualities. And what I got in here is a sense of balance. And I got the time to grow up, and I got to do selfless things without anybody congratulating me. You know, and I found out how to be humble, you know, and I found out a lot about just, it's like I'm really into this Zen thing right now, and I'll end on this. I think it's beautiful because it's not anything special, but it allows me to differentiate what's going on here with what's going on out here. And it allows me to realize when I'm out of sorts up here, you know, that my life is going to be out of sorts. But when I realize that and can just relax, you know, it's like my life is good. You know, I have great friends. I have people that care about me, people that love me. you know, and I have another opportunity just today to make the right decision, to do the right thing, to live this life to the best of my ability today. I'm giving it my, I gave you guys my best shot, and thank you again.